The Fourth District Appellate Court of the State of Illinois has reconvened. The Honorable Craig H.D. Armon presiding.
Morning, Council. We'll call 4-23-0127, Sean Ford et al. Appellees versus Gary D. Fitzgerald, Sr., Appellant. Could Council for the Appellant please state your name for the record?
This is Ryan Byers of Rammelkamp Bradney, PC, for the Defendant Appellant, Gary Fitzgerald, Sr.
Thank you, Mr. Byers. Counsel for the Appellee, could you please state your name for the record?
Nelson Mitten of Riesmanberger, PC, for the respondents.
Appellate. Thank you, Mr. Mitten. Mr. Byers, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court and counsel. This is a case in which the appellate court must determine whether it is proper for a trial court to disregard the clear, unambiguous language that a settlor included in her trust for the sake of reaching a result in terms of distribution that is preferred by the plaintiffs in the case. The precedent of the courts of this state establish that disregarding such language is an exercise in which trial courts cannot engage, absolutely cannot engage in. As the court is aware, the trusted issue here is that of Marjorie Fitzgerald. And the language that is to be construed is contained within that trust. Now, in the record below, over the months and years that this case has gone on, it has been somewhat unclear as to whether the plaintiffs are making an argument that the trust language is ambiguous or unambiguous. In fact, there's a reference in their first amended complaint to an ambiguity of intent. However, in their briefs before this court, it appears that the plaintiffs, appellees, have settled on the conclusion that the language that we're discussing of the Marjorie Fitzgerald Trust is, in fact, unambiguous language. Precedent is clear that when we have an unambiguous document, the Supreme Court has told us that courts cannot add to or modify the terms of that unambiguous document. One such case in which that rule was stated was Northern Trust Company v. Turee. That's 22 Illinois 2nd 290 from 1981. Furthermore, the Supreme Court has stated that where there is no ambiguity within a document, it is the plain language of that document that will control. One such case, including that rule, being Watkins v. Nobling, 22 Illinois 2nd 290 from 1961. This leads to the question of what is the unambiguous language of the Marjorie Fitzgerald Trust that we're here to discuss today. And the parties do not seem to disagree as to what the applicable paragraphs of the trust are, or even what it is that they state. And there are two trust paragraphs that are primarily at issue before the court today, and those are paragraphs 7.02 and 7.50 of the trust, both of which deal with distribution of trust property upon the passing of Marjorie Fitzgerald. And beginning with paragraph 7.02, it clearly states that after certain personal property is distributed to the defendant appellant, Gary Fitzgerald Sr., the balance of the trust up to the generation skipping trust exemption amount provided for in the Internal Revenue Code is to be divided into thirds, and each one of those thirds is to be given to a generation skipping trust, and there is one generation skipping trust established for each of Mrs. Fitzgerald's three grandchildren, two of whom are the plaintiffs and one of whom is Gary Fitzgerald the second.
So counsel, good morning. I'm
good
sorry,
morning.
Laryngitis here, so if you can't understand my question, let me know, or you can't hear me. But just following where you were going with this, doesn't that language at the same time say that real estate up to the GST exemption amount should be allocated for Gary Fitzgerald II. And therefore, how does this trust, or it tells us how the trust should be divided, or does it tell us how the trust should be divided when the only remaining asset is the real estate? And so, isn't there at least an implied ambiguity here in the language when we don't have that, information? How can the settlor's intent to divide the assets equally be reconciled with what you've just described and I've added?
Thank you, Your Honor. I believe that the intent that is stated is not an unqualified intent to divide the property equally. There is a statement regarding equal division of the property, but when that statement is made in paragraph 7.02 and 7.50, that is a qualified equal division of the property, and it is qualified with the language that Your Honor points out, that the real estate is to be given to the generation skipping trust for the benefit of Gary Fitzgerald II. And even if...
And that's notwithstanding there aren't any, the situation where there aren't any other assets like here. Is that right?
That is correct, Your Honor. And admittedly, the trust does not explicitly state that if the only asset is real estate, then that provision regarding assignment of the real estate to Gary Fitzgerald II's trust still applies. We have to acknowledge that is not explicitly stated. However, it is also not explicitly stated that if the only remaining asset is real estate, that the real estate should be divided among the three grandchildren's generation skipping trusts. And Your Honor had asked, does this create an ambiguity, at least an implicit ambiguity in the language of the document? First, we would say to that, if there is such an ambiguity, that is not raised by the plaintiff's appellants before this court. The position that they have taken is that this is an unambiguous document. And if, in fact, it is considered to be ambiguous, there are rules of construction that the Supreme Court and the other courts of this state have established for construing ambiguous documents. And those rules would lead to the conclusion that the real estate still ought to be assigned to the generation skipping trust for the benefit of Gary Fitzgerald II. Specifically, some of those rules that are at play is that when we're talking about choosing between multiple constructions, and there is a construction that will give effect to all of the provisions of the trust, the court must adopt that construction. And the construction that was adopted by the trial court, again, if we're assuming there was an ambiguity, our primary position is that there is not, and the other party's position as well is that there's not. But if we're going to choose between two interpretations of the document, the interpretation advocated for by the appellee gives effect to the provision that says all the real estate is to be received by the trust for the benefit of Gary Fitzgerald II. If the interpretation that was adopted by the trial court is allowed to stand, that language effectively becomes a nullity and is read out of the document altogether. And if what we're doing is construing an ambiguous document, rules of construction indicate that we should give all language effect to the extent that it is possible.
But doesn't your position, counsel, effectively disinherit the two granddaughters?
Effectively, it does, Your Honor. That is absolutely correct. However, there are cases in which it is indicated that in light of clear language of a trust, such a disinheritance will be allowed to stand. And in particular, I would point the court's attention to the case of Larrison v. Record, which is cited to in our brief and is a Supreme Court case from 1987, 117 Illinois 2nd, 444. And in that case, we had a circumstance in which there were a married couple, there was a married couple, and they both had children from previous relationships. And at issue was a will which resulted in the child of the first party to pass away being disinherited. And the argument before the Supreme Court was that clearly this could not have been the intention of the married couple to disinherit the, I believe it was the husband's daughter. However, that is the effect that the language of the instrument had when applied to the facts that were present at the time of the death of the wife, who was the second of the couple to die. And the Illinois Supreme Court in that case declined to alter the provisions or alter the distribution under that will simply because it led to the daughter's disinheritance. The language of these documents is paramount, and the language of these documents must be followed.
Mr. Byers, you point out in your brief that actually plaintiffs are not heirs at law under the laws of intestacy. Defendant is the decedent's sole surviving heir. Does that, what significance is that fact to either the case law that has been cited by plaintiffs or your analysis here relative to the trust document?
Well, thank you, Your Honor. And we had included that argument and that law proactively anticipating an argument that we had seen the plaintiffs make in the past. And there had been a law that was cited to by the plaintiffs that they argued stood for the proposition that because the grandchildren were individuals who would be treated equally under intestacy law, there had to be some sort of special showing before they could be disinherited. And we made that argument in our brief, anticipating that argument from plaintiffs again. But plaintiffs in their response brief actually stated that they were making no such argument. So at that juncture, I think the point effectively becomes a moot one if plaintiffs are not even raising that argument. But the fact remains that if there were an argument made that there had to be a special showing of disinheritance because these individuals were heirs at law, they're not heirs at law. The only heir at law is the sole surviving child of Marjorie Fitzgerald, who is in fact Gary Fitzgerald Sr.
Thank you.
Thank you. I would also like to, returning to the language of the trust itself. We discussed a bit paragraph 7.02, but it should be noted that paragraph 7.02 does not stand alone. Paragraph 7.02 states that the distributions made under it are subject to the generation skipping trust provisions that are contained within paragraph 7.50 of the trust. And if we go to paragraph 7.50, we have again an unambiguous statement in that paragraph that when dividing the trust real estate among the generation skipping trusts for the three grandchildren, all real estate should be allocated to the generation skipping trust for the benefit of Gary Fitzgerald II, which again is a further indication and further reinforcement that the benefit of the real estate going to Gary Fitzgerald II was the true intention of Marjorie Fitzgerald. Every time that the real estate is explicitly mentioned in connection with being distributed to these generation skipping trusts, there is a statement that it is to be allocated, again, up to one third of the generation skipping trust exemption amount. It is to be allocated to the generation skipping trust for the benefit of the grandson, not of the granddaughters. Also, and hopefully this was apparent from the briefs, but just to reemphasize, there is no contention either in the motion from summary judgment that the ruling on which is being appealed from, nor is there a contention in the briefs before this court that there was any property to be distributed other than real estate. So we truly are dealing with a situation, or at least an argument for these purposes, where only real estate is at issue. And there was also no issue raised in either the motion for summary judgment or the briefs before this court that the value of the real estate to be divided was less than one third of the applicable generation skipping trust exemption. And in fact, that value was established by an appraisal that was introduced into the record by the plaintiffs themselves when taking the discovery deposition of Gary Fitzgerald II. So as a result of this unambiguous language of the trust and those surrounding facts, the defendant trustee, upon Marjorie Fitzgerald's death, did in fact allocate that real estate solely to the generation skipping trust for the benefit of Gary Fitzgerald II. The plaintiffs, in their motion for summary judgment and in this appeal, seek to have that distribution undone now, with the real estate being divided equally among the generation skipping trusts for the benefit of each of the three grandchildren, and that is what the trial court below ruled. The only way for that ruling to stand is to ignore the specific language about real estate that is included not once but twice in the trust, and is included every time in the trust that there is a specific mention of distribution of real estate. So with all due respect to the trial court, its ruling on the motion for summary judgment read out of the trust Marjorie Fitzgerald's unambiguous direction that her grandson was to have the benefit of that real estate. And this court, the Fourth District Appellate Court, in a case called Estate of Kratz, which is 168 Illinois 3rd, 545, made it abundantly clear that a trial court cannot rewrite a testamentary document based solely on its notion of what is fair. Again, with respect to the trial court, we believe that that is what was done in the ruling on the motion for summary judgment below. That is in direct contravention of this court's directive in Kratz and in contravention of decisions of the Illinois Supreme Court. For that reason, Your Honors, we would ask that the ruling on the motion for summary judgment be overturned. Reserving rebuttal, that concludes my remarks.
All right. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Mitten for the appellee.
Thank you, Your Honors. Opposing counsel. Mr. Byers is correct that we basically do not believe there is an ambiguity here, but we also believe that the interpretation given this trust by the trial court is the correct one, rather than the one given by the trustee in this case. It's fairly, we both agree that we are looking primarily at section 7.02 and 7.50 of the trust. But in both of those sections, the grantor, Ms. Fitzgerald, clearly states that she is giving her property, all of her property, to be distributed equally among the three trusts for her grandchildren. There is no qualification to that contained within that particular sentence. And therefore, it's our position that that's the clear language of the trust, and that should be followed as followed by the trial court.
Mr. Mitt, may I ask you a question just in terms of the record? Does the record establish how long the farm ground had been in the family or the property of the decedent?
I don't know if it's actually committed. It had been with the property of the family for many years.
Okay. And does the record establish whether Gary II farmed that ground, actively farmed the ground that's at issue, and whether or not any other family members farmed that ground?
No, I don't believe the record clearly makes that in terms of the summary judgment.
Okay. Even as to whether or not Gary II farmed that ground?
I think that's clear. He did farm the ground, Jim.
Okay. Thank you.
Counsel, when you were focusing on the word, good morning, when you were focusing on the word all, don't we need to apply the principle of something more specific controls? And here there was a designation of the real estate property going to Gary Fitzgerald II. So wouldn't that supersede the word all in terms of what needs to be looked at to ascertain the meaning of the language in this trust?
Well, I'm not really sure you can do that, Judge, because of the fact that, again, you're looking at the term all. I mean, there may be what I think, and this is where maybe we disagree, and I disagree with others, opposing counsel on this. When you look at that language, there may have been an intent not to break up the farm at the time, even though the value of the farm was to be distributed among the three trusts. But I do not believe that you can interpret this language when you talk about all. Even if you go back, if attachments to the trust, as indicated in the record, basically list the property, and it's the real estate and the other property is listed in it, and other there at the time, I believe there was some stock, but that was gone by the time of the death of the settler. And so therefore, at that time, you know, the only property was the trust. So you're basically, if you allocate only the farmland to Gary II, you are basically saying that the first line is completely being read out of the trust.
Well, but doesn't the language you just talked about, isn't that language qualified by the language that the allocations for the grandchildren under that paragraph 7.02 shall be subject to the GST separate trust provisions set forth in 7.50? And in that section, it specifically indicates that when allocating the property between these three trusts, all real estate held in this trust shall be allocated, shall. If we want to pick one word out, which is what you're doing with all, let's pick another one out, shall be allocated to the Gary II GST trust, essentially, up to the allowable amount, which is one third of the total GST exemption amount. And nobody disagrees with the fact that the total value of the land that remains available is less than the amount that is exempted.
Well, I want to deal with the latter one. I'm not so sure that if this goes back to the trial court, we will agree with that. What we wanted to do at this point was get an interpretation of the trust. So we did not go into whether there was property beyond that under the generation skipping trust. But for the for the purposes of the appeal, we'll just assume that.
And by interpreting the trust, you mean getting a construction of the trust.
Right, correct? Getting a construction of the trust.
Yes. So to properly allege the right to go in and try to construe the trust, you have to allege an ambiguity.
Yes, and I believe the ambiguity is created by the two interpretations, Judge, in the sense that there are two interpretations. We also requested...
You didn't claim either an actual or latent ambiguity in your complaint, did you?
No, Your Honor, but by the same token, how are we to get an interpretation of the trust unless we either do it by construction or by the declaratory judgment, which is count six, which specifically says we want to get this interpreted in some fashion because the interpretation of the trustee was contrary to the interpretation of my clients of the trust.
How you do it is between you and the trial court. We're the reviewing court.
I understand.
So what we're left with is what's the record that you gave us?
The record is that the record is that the judge granted the summary judgment as to both count one for a construction of the trust, as well as count six for a declaratory judgment as to the interpretation of the language of the trust. So we believe under either of those counts, we can get the construction, get the court to basically interpret what is the proper reading of this trust.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah. So that is the basis for both the motion for summary judgment at the trial court as well now and now confronting this appellate court.
Go ahead. Proceed with your argument. I apologize. I didn't mean to take you off track.
No. That's perfectly fine. So, Judge, Your Honors, we firmly believe that, we think that if there was going to be if Ms. Fitzgerald was going to basically automatically give all of the property to Gary Jr., she would not have put in the language at the beginning of both 7.02, 7.50, which shows a clear intent to distribute all of it to all three grandchildren.
Subject to the provisions.
Subject to the provisions, yes.
Doesn't that mean anything?
I think it means something only to the extent that she indicated her intent. She didn't want the property, the real estate, broken up at that point. That she did not necessarily, upon her death, mean that all of the property was going to be broken up. Because there's provisions in the trust for the trustee to take actions concerning. But otherwise, it would have had to have been partitioned immediately.
Well, but they're all contingent upon there being more land than the exemption limits for the GST trust.
Well, what you're saying is that the contingency of what would be distributed from what I call the residuary clause under 7.02 would have to mean that the real estate would have to all have a value above the GST limit. But our position is that even if the property, the real estate was not above the GST limit, it still needed to be distributed equally among all three grandchildren. And that, again, what the whole concept of the GST limit is to try to create an effective allocation under the tax laws as opposed to the basically how she was going to distribute her property. So what we are contending is that if you, again, as we said, if you read it the way that the appellant is reading it, you are basically disinheriting the other two grandchildren, which would, again, fly straight into the statement made at the beginning of both 7.02 and 7.50, which clearly indicates an intent to distribute all of the property to equally among the three grandchildren. We think a better interpretation of this would be that basically the reason it was put into one trust to begin with was to avoid immediate partition of the property, rather than basically to say the other two grandchildren get nothing because value of the real estate did not exceed the generation skipping tax.
But it wouldn't, if there was concern about partition, she could have included language that they're going to get an undivided X percentage.
Well, I understand that, Judge, but that's not how it's written. And again, the clear intent.
That's my point. There's no specific reference to that. It doesn't. Your assumption is she didn't want to partition the land.
No,
and the only reason that that assumption exists is so that there's something there to give to the other two, or to the plaintiffs.
Well,
because now we have nothing left but land.
No, and I understand that, Judge. And that's the reason that I still believe that if you look at the plain language right at the beginning, that's what articulates her clear intent.
I mean, I appreciate the fact that that's what you've got to argue, but it just kind of ignores all the rest of the language of the trust. And you kind of wonder, I thought we were supposed to take all of this in conjunction with each provision.
Well, I understand that, but I believe that you have to look paramount at the interpretation as given by 7.02 and 7.50. And that's the interpretation given by the trial court, to which we agree.
Go ahead, Mr. Minton. I took you off the track again.
No, that's fine. Your Honors, I really don't have, unless I have any questions, there's one thing that I do want to correct, which Mr. Byers pointed out in my paragraph section C. I misquoted miscited a statute concerning whether there was a requirement of an accounting at the time that the trustee became the trustee. I cited the current language, which actually was incorrect because it had been changed. The site had been changed in 2020. The requirement for a trust accounting to all beneficiaries was actually at the time that the trustee came in was 760 ILCS 5/11 (A), (A). And again, that language is identical to what's contained in the current language. And so I do apologize to the court and Mr. Byers for misciting that at the time.
Mr. Minton, just one final question from my point here. In terms of the standard of review, do you agree that it's de novo?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
Because we're interpretation of the trust.
Yes, I had one further question, excuse me, also. Why shouldn't your claims be barred by laches here? The suit was not brought until January 26, 2017, and no inquiry was made about this for at least 6 years, I believe, after Settlor passed away. Why shouldn't your claims be barred, your client's claims be barred?
Well, I think it goes back to exactly what we're talking about is the trustee in this instance, there's no evidence that my clients knew about that there was a trust. They knew they were supposed to get some, they believed they were supposed to get some distribution out of the estate, but they did not know about a trust until at least according to the record, until 2016, when finally they got a notice from the trustee saying that there is going to be some sort of distribution per the terms of the trust. And therefore, at that time, they inquired, well, what's the trust? They asked for a copy of the trust. And that's where the court ultimately held that because the trust, these were clearly beneficiaries under the trust. And under Illinois law, they were required to be given an accounting of the trust from the day that he assumed responsibility for it. So therefore, his failure to basically take that action basically did not put my clients on notice that they had a claim under a trust. They believed, again, that it was supposed to be distributed under the estate. And again, they did not have it. They did make some inquiries. But again, that's what the trial court held was until basically 2016, my clients did not know about the terms of the trust and therefore took effective action within that period of time.
All right. Looks like there are no other questions. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Byers, rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. One of the things that has been a bit difficult about defending this case is that the plaintiffs seem to want to do this dance of the trust is ambiguous in one moment when it suits them, and then the trust isn't ambiguous, you know, when that suits them. And coming into today's arguments based on the briefs, I was under the impression that everybody was now in agreement that the trust was an unambiguous document. However, in the plaintiff's comments just now, we're talking about there being multiple interpretations. We're talking about you can read it one way, you can read it another way, and this argument is now full of the language of ambiguity again. And perhaps that's because, as I believe Judge DeArmond pointed out with one of his questions and is cited to in our brief, without an ambiguity, there's no jurisdiction to construe a trust in the first place. And again, there is no ambiguity alleged in the complaint. So again, it's been our position all along. If that's the case, we don't know why it is that we're sitting here talking about an ambiguity when the first amended complaint doesn't cite to ambiguous language to begin with. But the fact of the matter is, even if this document is going to be considered ambiguous, the rules of construction, as have been indicated throughout the court's questioning, the rules of construction still lead to the conclusion that Mr. Fitzgerald's, Gary Fitzgerald Sr.'s interpretation of the trust is the correct one. Again, more specific language, such as the language regarding the real estate, must control over more general language regarding property. That is from McCreary v. Bermood, 332 Illinois 645, Supreme Court case from 1928. Also, it's very interesting that counsel for the plaintiffs focuses in on the word all, which occurs relatively early in the relevant paragraphs. Rules of construction, if we are going to apply rules of construction as though this is an ambiguous trust, those rules of construction say that language appearing later in a document is to be given favor over language appearing earlier in a document as a more recent statement of the settlor's intent. That comes from cases such as Weilmuster v. Swainer, which is 404 Illinois 21 from 1949. So again, it is our position that this document is unambiguous. It is our position that the unambiguous reading of the document results in the real estate being distributed to Gary Fitzgerald II's generation skipping trust. But even if we're playing in a world where this document is ambiguous, which it was never alleged to be, rules of construction still lead to the same result that defendants have been urging all along. And I would also briefly like to address the question regarding the Lashes argument. Mr. Mitten's comment was Lashes cannot operate to bar counts of the complaint because there was no knowledge about the trust until 2016. However, there's documentation in the record in a form of a letter from the plaintiff's counsel, which says that they knew upon their grandmother's death that they were, in their minds at least, entitled to an equal distribution out of her estate. And whether they knew about a specific trust instrument or did not know about a specific trust instrument, when they thought that they were entitled to an equal distribution and that equal distribution was not forthcoming, that put them on a duty, on notice to inquire further.
Mr. Byers, of what relevance is the doctrine of laches in this appeal?
Well, Your Honor, originally, the very first complaint, and I see that I'm out of time. Would you like me to finish answering the question?
Please. Yes, please.
The doctrine of laches was originally a basis for dismissal of the plaintiff's first complaint, of the first amended complaint, and then that dismissal was reconsidered. And this is a situation where most of the counts of the plaintiff's complaint, first amended complaint, in some way relate to a breach of fiduciary duty, which the court will be aware has a five-year statute of limitations associated with
it. Mr. Byers, let me interrupt you. I'll shorten this. Is it an issue? Was there a cross motion for summary judgment? Is it before this court in some way?
There was not a cross motion, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
All right. Thank you, counsel. We appreciate your arguments. The court will take this matter under advisement. The court stands in recess.